This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning for Morningstar.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer for Morningstar Research Services.
On the podcast today, we welcome back Jamie Hopkins. Jamie is Managing Partner of Wealth Solutions at Carson Wealth. He's also a finance professor of practice at Creighton University's Hyder College of Business. Jamie and Ron Carson co-wrote a new book called Finding Your Freedom, Financial Planning for a Life on Purpose. Jamie also wrote the book Rewirement, Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement. Prior to joining Carson Group, he was with the American College of Financial Services, most recently serving as Director of Retirement Research. He received his bachelor's degree from Davidson College, his JD from Villanova University, and his LLM degree from Temple University. He's also a certified financial planner, a chartered financial consultant, and a chartered life underwriter. Jamie co-hosts his own podcast called Framework, and he's also active on social media. His Twitter handle is @retirementrisks. And before we get into the conversation today, we'd like to share a bit of disclosure. CWM LLC, an affiliate of Carson Group, licenses and/or offers products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates. Jamie, welcome back to The Long View.
Thank you again for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to have you here. And we want to talk about your new book to start. The book is called Finding Your Freedom. And both you and your co-author, Ron Carson, share some of your own money stories in the early part of the book and really throughout the book. And you've talked to us previously about how you didn't grow up in a wealthy household. So why is thinking through early money memories helpful in understanding how we approach our money today and also what the trouble spots might be for us?
There's a lot of reasons why it's helpful to examine those early money memories and relationships and then some of the trouble spots. And it's probably impossible to identify all the trouble spots, but I'll start with something up front there. And the first one is, you know, this is something I've changed my view on over time, which is how important this relationship that we have with money is to our decision making. And I didn't used to think about it as a relationship. I used to just think, well, there's money and you do financial planning. And the more time I've spent with it and interacting with people, I realize that we really do have like a true relationship, that some people, right, have a good relationship and some people have a fearful relationship and some people have, you know, a relationship and they don't really talk about it much. And all of those dynamics then start having some interplay with how we make our decisions to invest, to save, to spend money, even starts impacting our relationships with our family and our spouse. And a lot of that gets passed on, not just from our early money memories, but our parents' memories and our grandparents. And, you know, Ron, who's the co-author, would say it can go back 8 generations. I don't know if I can trace it back that far, but at least like 2. It's pretty easy for me to trace back some of my relationships. So I think the more that we understand how those are impacting us and the more clarity we get around it, we can make better decisions. And I mean better decisions in the sense of, right, just with more information. We can only make decisions based on the information we have. And so the more we examine that, I think it opens up our mind to, you know, why we feel the way we do and whether or not we want to continue to operate that way.
Well, one question I had, Jamie, relates to your personal story, which you shared with us when you're on the podcast before, but I'm wondering if you can kind of refresh people's memories or bring them up to speed if they weren't listening before. It sounds like you did not come from a family of privilege. You had early tragedy in your family, and I guess my question is, how has that affected your thought about how people without a lot of financial wherewithal can access financial advice? And how could the system maybe better serve them than it does today?
It's a great question. And I'll try to unravel maybe 3 parts of it. And the first one's about like privilege. And I would say, though, like, I was brought up with privilege in the sense I had an incredibly intelligent mom and a strong family and were born in the United States and, you know, white male. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that probably additive to my life. So I don't know that I look back in that sense of privilege, but in the sense that you were referring to, like, we grew up in a household with two parents that didn't go to college, that, you know, worked in construction, you know, like didn't grow up with a lot of financial money as a kid. And my story mostly revolves around my dad passing away when I was 8. And he did construction and roofing, gutters, fascia, soffit, everything high up on a ladder. And he went up during the winter and started raining, and aluminum ladders freeze over faster than a roof does. So he was finishing up a job and coming down the ladder and slipped and fell and was gone. So I went to school that day having a dad and came home from school that day and he was gone. And kind of similarly to our family, right? We went into that day with somebody who is the breadwinner for the family and ended that day without that person. And, you know, we got by on things like Social Security checks and, you know, our church and members there, I know, donated money to my mom and kind of helped us get by for a while. And you don't know that at the time, right? Like, I remember government checks coming. I didn't know there were Social Security checks. I didn't even know a lot about, like, the church and others donating money till many years later. It's not something my mom was telling us at the time. And I also didn't realize that, like, that type of family setting and household isn't the group that gets much financial advice. Even in the basics in that situation of, you know, that's a perfect example of my family, of somebody who should have had term life insurance for, you know, a dangerous job with two young children and, you know, kind of really driving the income of the family, but didn't. And we didn't have any of that. And I still say today, in a little bit of tongue in cheek, like, I still don't think I've run into an advisor that said they specialize in non-college educated construction workers, right? Like, that niche area still seems unexplored. And that, like, I don't want that to be the case, right? Like, my mom and my family, like, I want them and everybody like them that doesn't come through a kind of a more wealthy channel to access to financial advice, they're worthy of financial advice and should get it. And that's where, you know, democratizing advice, the term I like to use, really needs to happen. And I think that we will get there, but it's not happening fast.
You make the point in the book that reflecting on and communicating our own life experiences and attitudes about money can help us in our relationships with our loved ones, especially our spouses. Can you expand on that point a bit?
Yeah, I'd expand on that point a bit. It's a great question. And again, these are things you learn over time. And I didn't realize all of this when I was younger, but it's a little bit of something I talk about with my mom and my grandmother and my aunt, too, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. I went back to the Netherlands and it was part of her, you know, funeral. We talked about this, which is the three of them are all very big gift givers, right? Like, it's how they express their love, is they buy gifts for their family members. And they do a lot of that through holidays and birthdays, especially Christmas in our family is a big gift-giving season. And so when I was a kid, I remember my mom, what I would say is overbuying for Christmas, right? She would always say, hey, this is the last year. I'm not going to buy more than I did the previous year. And she'd buy so many gifts. And that's how she expressed her love to, you know, her children who are brothers and sisters and her family. It's how my grandmother expressed her love to her family. It's how my Aunt Patricia expressed her love to her family. But all three of them suffered from the same flip side, is none of them had a tremendous amount of money. And I remember in January when that bill would come due, my mom would be super stressed. And this occurred year after year after year. And actually this Thanksgiving, my stepdad and I were actually talking about it, that my mom did not do a great job of thinking about the future, even in, you know, 2-3 months away. Like, how am I going to pay for those once I buy all this? And that created in me actually a little bit of, I guess, the opposite reaction, that I'm not a big fan of gifts. I kind of question it a little bit. And, you know, I don't enjoy receiving gifts. And so it created this aspect in me. Well, now I marry somebody, Kathy, my wife, and I have to figure out, like, how do we address that topic, right? Like, I have my experience, my mom has her experience, and Kathy's going to have a different experience. And then moving forward in our household, like, how do we come to agreement we've got three beautiful, wonderful kids on like how we give gifts. And it's really become a modification of gift giving and other experiences. I talk about this a little bit in the book too, which is we have our kids pick charities to give to for their nieces, their cousins, my nieces and nephews. And so we've shifted a little bit of that gift giving to something that I have a better relationship with and that my wife also has a good relationship with. Now, if I didn't address that, that would have created conflict in our own marriage, in our own kind of structure around money. So understanding, and I'm sure that there's a bunch that I don't understand and haven't figured out, but that's what I have, right? So we've addressed one, there's probably 50 ones that I haven't.
I wanted to ask, and I've contemplated this when I've thought about money memories and people talking about the importance of them. I guess I've wondered, is it possible that a life experience that we might have had that's not explicitly financially related might shape our financial behavior? So, for example, you know, maybe someone had scarcity in some area of their lives, not physical scarcity or a lack of funds, but like maybe, you know, just felt like there wasn't enough love to go around in the house or whatever it is. Is it possible that people's financial behaviors and their thoughts about money might be shaped by life events that aren't really financial in nature?
I think absolutely. You know, the way that I look at human behavior, right, is we have this nature part of us plus the environment that we're in. And this is probably true for a lot of behavioral finance researchers and academics is we've probably focused too much on the individual and saying like, we're going to change you and less on the environment. And the environment doesn't have to be about money to shape our decision-making, right? So we can absolutely have financial decisions and a process that we orient ourselves to later in life based off the environment that we've come through. So, you know, it could be totally unrelated to directly just to money memories, but other memories, as you said, like, is it, you know, you didn't feel love, that you suffered physical abuse and you have trust issues? Well, like, trust is a fundamental part of our financial system. And if you were abused as a kid, which, you know, a lot of individuals were, then that's going to play itself out in your decision making, your ability to interact in lots of different spectrums across your life. And if you didn't feel that you were worthy of people's time, then why would you feel that you're worthy of financial advice or worthy of wealth? And all those things are going to impact the way that we behave and act later in life. So I think, yeah, that's exploring all of that is super important. And it's not just the money aspect of it that is, you know, a factor in determining how we make decisions and behave later on.
In the book, you urge people to go through an exercise where they define financial freedom. You note that responses typically range from the freedom from doing something to the freedom to do something. Why do you think that's so telling?
Yeah, the whole, does freedom mean freedom from or freedom to, right? Is it freeing you up from things that you feel like are holding you back in life? And that's almost the running away from something versus the freedom to go somewhere and to explore something. And I do think that's really telling in, are you escaping or are you going to a place. I often talk to this about people. I just, you know, happen to run into a lot of it is when people are switching jobs for whatever reason. I feel like I have a lot of conversations about that. I had a 45-minute call today. One of my friends just called me and said, "Can I talk to you?" And we talked through a job opportunity for him. And, you know, I tend to approach that the same way. Are you running away from a job, right? You're unhappy at your current job and you're just trying to find a new place. Or are you really being purposeful and where you're going, and you're running to an opportunity? And I think when you start defining freedom and what the future looks like, if it feels like you're escaping from things, I usually tell people to like question it a little bit more. Like, well, is that just you don't like what's occurring today, or are you really designing what you want the future to be, right? Are you designing that next job opportunity and what financial freedom means? And yeah, you can answer in both ways. And sometimes it's okay to run away from something, right? Like, it's not saying that's inappropriate in all situations. But I would, if you have the ability to, I'd rather see you design it in the way you want it to be, so you have the freedom to do things instead of the freedom just to escape things.
So in the book, you take pains to distinguish goals from aspirations. I'm wondering if you can discuss the difference and why you think we need to have both goals and aspirations. And maybe you can share an example or two about what's a goal, what's an aspiration.
I can totally share examples, and I'll use a almost real-time story around this one. I like to tell stories, which if you've made it this far, you've already heard like four. So, and I will give a shout-out. I'm trying to continuously do this around this point, which is Dennis Mosley Williams, who's kind of a speaker, coach, thought leader in our industry, is actually the one that really opened my mind to this goals versus aspirations conversation. I mean, I knew about both of them before, but I didn't put it together well. And so I try to give him a shout-out for enlightening me in this area. And so goals are what I view as very specific, and I even go through like SMART goals in the book and how to set them. You know, they're very specific, time-bound, measurable items. Aspirations are a little bit bigger than that. And so I usually think about goals as mile markers along the way to some ultimate outcome that you want to achieve, which I would define as aspirational. And there's the simple version, then I'll use kind of my life one that came up last weekend. So if you want to be, let's pick a great philanthropist, and that's your aspiration in life, is to give back to the world and community and have this impactful change. Well, your goals are going to be things like give $1 million by 65 and like give $2 million by 67 and help get on a board of this foundation. They're all just markers, right? You can put times, you can make them super specific, but not any one of them makes you a great philanthropist. They're all just markers to kind of show that you're on the way, the path to that. And the reality is, like, maybe there is no end in what is a great philanthropist, that there isn't a way to fully achieve it, but you're always aspiring to be that, right? That's your aspiration. You'll live your whole life aspiring and chasing that ultimate outcome. And that's great. Like, that's the journey. It's the process. And we keep setting different mile markers to make sure we're along the way. You know, having a successful retirement is the money version of it. That might be your aspiration. But then you have a whole bunch of other stuff. Save $1 million by this age, right? Have this amount of income, defer Social Security. Those all become goals that help us to that aspiration. Now, I'll use my personal story. Was 2 weekends ago now, which was I was supposed to run the Philadelphia Marathon. And I've run about, I don't know, 15, 16 marathons. I've done 2 Ironmans. I played college sports all through that. That's been a long time now, so I don't know how relevant that one is anymore. The relevancy of that reference is a little bit dated. But I've been an active runner for a long time. And the night before, my wife was like, you really shouldn't run. I had all my stuff laid out. I picked up my bib. I had my gels, my shoes. I had my outfit picked out. And, you know, I was all ready to go. I had my alarm set. And my wife really ended up talking me out of it. And what happened was, I was like, well, you know, like, I'm faster than 95% of the people that run it. And she's like, well, like, is that really your desired outcome, is that you're faster than 95%? And I was like, well, no, but I set it as a goal to run another one this year. So I want to check off that goal. And she's like, but is that really important? Like, what is the purpose of all this? And we got back to, like, you know, my life aspiration around my health is to be healthy when I'm like 85, so I can be playing with grandkids or great grandkids. Like, that's where I want to be. And I've talked about that. And she's right. Like, running the marathon now, which I wasn't as well trained for, I've been traveling a lot. And, you know, I didn't need to do that. That I was putting a short-term goal in front of a long-term aspiration, which is my long-term health, over running another marathon this year, which ultimately, like, that at $5 is $5, right? So I did end up not doing it. And she kind of helped me steer back to that life aspiration and not let me put a short-term goal in front of a more important long-term outcome.
You characterize the path to financial freedom is kind of a Maslow's hierarchy. Can you talk about that?
So Maslow's hierarchy is probably overused, and I overused it again too. But a lot of people can visually connect to it. We know what it is. So it's a good starting point. And I do think it's actually just true that we as humans will struggle to move upward and onward in a lot of aspects of our life if we can't take care of the basics. If we wake up and we're in pain, it's hard to move to the next thing. If we wake up and we're hungry or we go to bed thirsty, it's hard to move to the next thing. And that holds people back. And it, you know, it's one of the things that keeps me up at night is all the children we have in this country and the world that go to bed hungry and thirsty. And it's probably my bigger life aspiration, too, is to have an impact there. And that's the base part of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that are shelter, food, water. And then as we move up, we can find the self-actualization up on the top of it. But we've got to take care of these community and social belonging and all these other things along the way, too. And the reality is to, you know, define what freedom means to you. We've got to find financial freedom, that if we wake up every day and we're worried about where our next paycheck is going to come from, how we're going to meet our expenses, that our debt's getting out of hand, that we can't see ourselves worthy of financial advice, we can't move up to finding our own life freedom. We can't move up to self-actualization because we're going to be bogged down with getting by in the financial side of our life. And that's one of the biggest things that shows up when you're talking about divorces and couples therapy. It's a big part of, you know, a lot of anxiety, and even people who struggle at the workplace and jobs is around finances, that they're worried about their own finances at home. And so we see the impact of this all over the place in society, but we don't tend to fully address it, that if we want healthier people that can challenge their own freedom and drive down that path of self-actualization, they have to feel worthy of financial advice and take care of the basics of their needs. And so that's kind of where we spend the book, is, you know, figuring out this financial freedom part through financial planning so that you can live that life on purpose and find your true freedom.
Well, I want to switch over to discuss financial planning matters, because there's a lot of good, concrete financial planning advice in the book. And one topic you discuss is this idea of bucketing, that bucketing our money by time horizon can be a healthy form of mental accounting, you argue, and I happen to believe. Many of our listeners probably have heard of bucketing in the retirement context, but you think it's actually sort of a helpful framework at other life stages as well. So maybe you can talk about that and also give us a sense of how you think about this bucketing structure, how it works.
I love bucketing, and I know that you know I do too. So I'm glad to be glad to talk about it. And, you know, you've had a big impact on me on this too, and just, you know, listening to you and your writings and, you know, your commentary on it. There's some other people out there too, at Carson Wealth. We've started to use it since I've been here for about 4 years with our clients. And one of my friends, Jason Smith, wrote a book on bucketing called The Bucket Plan. And there's a couple, some other people too out there. But when I started looking at it originally, I viewed it as very different from the other ways that retirement income planning was done. And I viewed that we had all these different categories and structures and distribution rules, that you got 4% systematic withdrawals and you've got annuities and flooring. And then I realized that I think the power of bucketing wasn't the bucketing that I saw originally, which was kind of a way to determine allocation across time horizons, but that bucketing was really more in that mental accounting and storytelling. And I don't mean to like put it down as storytelling, because storytelling is like one of the most powerful things that human beings have ever created. It's how we pass along our information, and it's how we, you know, create boundaries in the world and create action. So storytelling is really powerful. And what I saw that bucketing allowed us to do was become a communication and storytelling, you know, kind of mechanism, so that people could understand their plans and actually adhere to them. Because we do treat money differently based on where it sits and where it comes from and what it's going to be used for. And we can't ignore that behavioral aspect of, you know, people when we create plans, that something might be super efficient, but people might hate it. And airlines have learned that, that the way that we board planes, we can create really efficient structures and people can still hate them and then not want to fly. The same thing occurs in financial planning. We can create a really efficient plan that is not very, you know, kind of adaptive to a person's life. And I think bucketing really does that. And it leans into a, you know, behavioral trait that most people have, in the sense of mental accounting. It's how we already operate in our lives. And I also think it's interesting because we use mental accounting in a lot of other areas of our lives, even outside of finance. So kind of to your earlier question, like, do other experiences color in the way that we behave with money? Yeah, The reality is some people really use bucketing from a time standpoint in their day. Like, we dedicate this time to this activity, and like, we're really good at that. We dedicate this day to this activity, and we're really good at that. So we spend a lot of time bucketing, probably every day, mentally counting time, energy. I used to make a joke that I was an energy camel, and I would save certain spurts of energy for certain activities, right? Like, if I had to get up and do a speech in front of people, I would pull my energy down through other things throughout the day to use it for that. That's like a form of mental accounting. I'm just accounting energy that, like, arguably maybe I should treat everything as, you know, of equal importance. Who knows? But I kind of did it in a different fashion.
Maybe to talk about some of the mechanics of bucketing. Most bucket systems use a cash bucket for short-term expected outlays and a more aggressive stock-heavy bucket for longer-term goals and expenditures. But what should go in the middle bucket, especially as we've seen bond prices get rocked by rising interest rates recently?
So I think the general theme of, you know, safer assets from a volatility standpoint earlier on and more volatile assets later on is a general theme of bucketing. However, I also think just the time horizon in which you are going to hold assets determines what goes into each bucket. And I will answer your question, but I'm just going to take a bit to get there. For instance, I often talk about housing wealth, and housing wealth for the median 65-year-old couple due to the last census, about two-thirds, 60% of the median U.S. couple's wealth at 65. So it's their largest asset. For somebody who's not going to tap into that asset till, you know, 85 or 80, it goes in bucket three. It's an asset. It needs to be accounted for. It's not a high growth asset, typically, you know, on average, but it's illiquid and we're not going to use it for a long time. So I would put that in bucket three. Now, if you're going to set up a line of credit and you want to do withdrawals from that in the first couple years, you could all of a sudden then shift home equity to bucket one or bucket two in that situation. Bucket two tends to be the hardest one to determine. And the reason for that is we have to figure out when to refill that bucket often, right? Whether we're using that to refill bucket one, if bucket one is mostly cash for 1 to 3 years, how often do we replenish? And then, you know, when do we replenish bucket two? It usually is more of a moderate mix of, if we're just thinking about investments, more of a moderate mix of investment classes. I've also seen things like using, you know, FIAs, so fixed index annuities. If you're trying to replace a bond ladder, perhaps in bucket two, there's some research that suggests that can be better, not always, but can be. So you can come up with a different mix of items in there. I don't think that there's one set philosophy for bucket two. And I do think all of this comes back to a little bit is, what are the assets? What's the cash flow? What's the ultimate goals and aspirations? And almost anyone's portfolio can be set up into buckets, no matter if we change the allocation or not. You can still show when you're going to use those assets and at what time period. So if you're, you know, a 50-50 bond stock-ish allocation and, you know, 10% in cash, maybe 10% in cash is the front end and the bonds shows the next 15 years and the stock is the 15 years after that. And we didn't really change your allocation, but we can explain how we're going to use these assets over time.
So, Jamie, just to pick up on your point about home equity and home ownership, one perennial question, especially for people who are getting close to retirement, is whether to accelerate mortgage pay down or invest in the market. How would you urge people to approach that question? And is it more or less settled, I guess, now that we have safer yields coming online on savings products that are in excess of many people's borrowing costs today?
Yeah, I don't know that it'll ever be settled, but it can ebb and flow based off of where rates are and the cost of borrowing and your kind of, you know, yield return on what makes better sense at a given time. Now, here's the thing I try to challenge people on home equity is that every single year we make a decision whether to borrow or to, right, essentially leave more invested or to leverage. It's not a one-time decision. A lot of people think about that as, you know, I go out and I buy a home and that was my decision. That's an annual decision, right? Like, we're constantly making that decision. If you get to retirement and you've paid off that mortgage and you decide not to go take out a new mortgage, you make the decision to not borrow, to leverage the property to some degree, to free up cash every single year. And it should be, to me, an annual decision. Like, I actually have gone on record before saying that's one of the biggest mistakes I think that the financial advisory world hasn't caught up on, is like talking through that every year. You know, the question there becomes, can I borrow often at a rate that is kind of cheaper than what I can get as a return elsewhere for a comparable level of risk? That's one of the conversations. Another one is cash flow. And I do think that there's a strong argument to, do you want to kind of move up cash flow earlier in retirement, because you actually, we get that smiling spend curve where we tend to spend more early in retirement and less later, you know, kind of in the middle, and perhaps even, you know, nominally at the end, inflation adjusted less. But that begs the question, like, should I be like pushing off one of my lowest performing assets to spend that down the longest? And I think in a lot of cases, it doesn't make sense. Now, I think this gets back to emotions, and that putting risk around the house is a scary thing, because if we lose our house somehow, then all of a sudden, like, the whole Maslow's hierarchy and financial hierarchy of needs is all disrupted. So I think we tend to be overly conservative with our house, which, you know, may or may not be a good thing. And I do think that we need to challenge that view a little bit and say, should we spend down home equity and leverage more often, especially in retirement, than historically we have?
Maybe sticking with the topic of home ownership, in the book, you discuss the role of home ownership as well as managing debt. Do you think today's high borrowing costs diminish the attractiveness of buying a home?
Yeah, it obviously has an impact. We can pretty much just look out at mortgage companies right now and see that, right, applications tremendously dropped once we saw an increase in rates. Now, depending on what day this goes out, you know, rates went up, they dropped a little bit for a couple weeks. I don't believe we're actually up past the like 2000, 2001 mortgage rate, at least as of the time of we're doing this recording. And so, but yeah, higher rates decreases the desire to borrow, and it decreases the desire to purchase a home. Now, that has to be viewed in comparison, I think, also with like how have home prices risen? What are the other opportunities out there? But it does have a big impact on that. Now, I'll tell a quick story here, at least about one area I know of, which is, you know, I was talking to a friend that's out in Southern California, and they were saying, hey, I really should I take this risk off the table with housing and everything and go like sell my house and go rent? And I actually went and looked in their area and realized that, like, look, like rent in that area went up significantly more than housing prices did. And even the cost, if you associated back in higher interest rates, it looks like rent had gone up, adjusted even more than that. So that's a really interesting like counter to it, which is the, you know, you had areas like Austin, same thing. Rent was the highest increase in the country in Austin. And, you know, the last year, and you might not be able to overcome that increase in cost in your area, even with higher borrowing rates.
I wanted to go back to the topic of retirement planning, which is where a lot of your expertise is, and your previous book was about retirement planning. This has been a really challenging year for people approaching and in retirement. So I guess the question is this year sort of the epitome of what we are thinking about and talking about when we're talking about sequence risk?
It really might be. This is probably, you know, basically one of the worst years ever when we talk about, you know, bond performance, especially to start the year, and market performance together. We hadn't really seen that. That was a scary year. There are some benefits. You know, I try to look at the positives for retirees too. I think one of the positives that I saw this year, which wasn't discussed a whole lot, but that actually, if you track that CPIE number, which is the Consumer Price Index experimental to track our senior spending, that actually trailed a decent amount under the CPIW numbers, which are, you know, often more the ones that we adjust inflation for things like Social Security. So if you actually look at those two, I think it was almost a percent higher at the third quarter on the CPIW, meaning that retirees actually got a kind of a benefit from higher inflation elsewhere this year, which is usually not the case. We're almost always, we have for about a decade now been higher on the senior side due to healthcare, and healthcare lagged other areas this past year. So there's a little bit of a silver lining out there. That's a small benefit for seniors. Seniors tend to own more home equity, but with less debt attached to it than younger people, which is actually kind of a double win there too. They're probably not buying new houses at the same levels, and they have more home equity, which appreciated a lot, which drove up a lot of the inflation numbers. And so if you actually look the last year on, I think, total net worth of Americans, I think we're still up a bit. So it's not like as bad as you might think with some of the headline market and bond performance at the beginning half of the year. And then lastly, if we can kind of stay the course this year, it's been pretty normal in, you know, midterm election years. We go back to like 1952, and it's like an average of what, 17-18% inter-year pull down average early September since World War II. And then you go out a year out from that, and it's been on average up about 20 some percent a year out from that entry year pullback date. It gets pretty normal in midterm election years to have the market side. I think with the bond portion occurring at the same time, really, really uncommon, right? It's basically the worst. And that's scary to people. High inflation. So you wrap all that together. And then I just try to balance it with some of the other pieces, right? Is home prices are up. Most retirees probably already locked in good rates, and total net worth might have gone up and might have actually benefited from Social Security adjustments this last year if you're a retiree. So it is not all bad news. I try to, you know, put some on both sides, but it's also real that it's a scary year to be, you know, a year or two out from retirement, or 1 or 2, 3 years into retirement.
One question we've asked ourselves, and one we've also put to previous guests, including Wade Fow and William Bengen, is how much sequence of inflation matters. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so sequence of inflation to me matters a lot. Wade and I have talked about that recently. The reason is, right, a high inflation early in retirement or life, I guess, possibly too, right, kind of permanently increases your cost over the life. Like, you would rather have high inflation the last couple years of your life than the first couple years of retirement, because you're then, let's say we even get back to 3% inflation, we're wrapping 3% on an already higher starting number. So that is a risk. I think the one flip side of the inflation numbers are we're not very good at predicting any of that. So I get a little bit, it's always like, well, you know, inflation's scary. Yeah. Even where we are today is lower than what the entire 1970s were, right, as a decade, like average. So it's high in comparison to where we have been. It is lower than a lot of Europe. I used to bring up when I taught in the RICP, Brazil, I think in 1990 or 1991, had 32,000% inflation in 1 year. And like my joke was, you'd want to pay for dinner before rather than after. But we're not experiencing things like that. We're experiencing high inflation for us, but we are not experiencing yet. And maybe inflation's already started to peak here, but we're not experiencing, I mean, the Netherlands and Europe, I was over, I mean, their inflation's higher. We're not experiencing the worst inflation we've ever seen in the history of the world. But it does decrease, especially retirees who can't move their income as much, right? Like, they really do see that decline in purchasing power over time, which I usually say, like, inflation is not for retirees usually a 1 or 2 year problem. It's a 30 year problem. That compounding over time is the really scary part. And does it end up depleting somebody's purchasing power in 15, 20, 25 years to the point where they can't live the life they want to live?
Well, yeah, sticking with that point of preserving purchasing power, that's really come up this year where we've seen Treasury inflation protected securities fall in price, even as they deliver some inflation adjustments. So how should people approach inflation protecting their portfolios? And maybe you can take it by, you know, sort of young accumulators, how should they think about it, as well as people who are in or nearing retirement?
It's a great question. And I do think, kind of even to your question statement, it depends. And I don't believe that there is a 100% accurate answer to this question. And it goes back to my point before, is we're not great at predicting inflation numbers just in general. I think you go back like 2 years ago, I don't think very many people had a good forecast into inflation. So it's pretty hard to predict it. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, different areas of the world being good protection. Generally speaking, equity markets have performed well as inflation hedges in the long term. They don't always align year to year. So like this year, it wouldn't be a great inflation hedge. But if we go out over a 10-year period, will it work? Possibly. It has historically worked pretty well. TIPS, you know, Dr. Michael Finca will argue that they're pretty good inflationary protection mechanisms. And, you know, maybe not for everybody. There are some products out there that will give you inflation protection. And I say some, and I put an asterisk here if you saw me in air quotes. They tend to be pretty expensive to purchase that, whether you're talking about a life or annuity product. I don't know that in those cases they actually work all that well. I just don't know that there's enough actual research going back on the historical performance on them to demonstrate it one way or the other. But there's some benefit there. When you think about retirees, to me, I still push this as pushing out Social Security is a good inflationary protection mechanism. The more you push out, the bigger bucket you have. And while, again, it is not perfect, it's not a one-to-one inflationary adjustment. The third quarter to third quarter adjustment this year was probably better than what seniors saw in actual inflation. In a lot of other years, it's been worse and it's always trailing a little bit, but that does help a lot. And it's kind of goes to the core that Social Security has worked fairly well in that regard of keeping seniors out of poverty. When we're working, I think the bigger thing is focusing on reinvesting back into yourself and your ability to move your own income up. And not everybody can do that. And I you know, want to acknowledge that. But if you're in one of those situations where you can drive that, that's going to be, you know, your human capital asset for younger individuals is going to be your big benefit to offsetting inflation to some degree, is that you can earn more money over time. And reality is sometimes you might need to switch jobs. And we know we talked about that briefly earlier. I didn't know this was going to be a call where I was like telling everybody to go find new jobs. But we saw that occur this last year and a half, right? The great resignation or whatever you want to call seems to have slowed down a bit. But I think that some of that was a reality, is that places were willing to pay more, which was also driving some of the inflation, and that people were looking around with costs of things and saying, I will make a move based off of finances and how much money I'm earning. And that's a reasonable decision to make. A lot of research shows that you do need to switch jobs kind of in that 5-year gap to really keep pace with your total earning potential, and that loyalty to companies doesn't always pay off.
You studied safe withdrawal rates for retirement in some detail, and you write about the topic in the book. How do you think people should figure out how much they can safely withdraw in retirement? Is the 4% guideline still a good benchmark in your opinion?
The 4%, well, I'm glad that we called it a guideline and not a rule. It's probably my biggest pet peeve is that we refer to it as a rule a lot. The, you know, safe withdrawal rates, I think I probably fall into the categories. I don't think that there's a safe withdrawal rate, meaning that like it's 100% safe. I think we can be pretty confident, but not 100%. Even, you know, the research of 4% didn't say that it was 100%. Sure and safe. It just what worked in the past. I think that things like whether it's 4% or 2.75 or 3, or is it 5%, all of that depends on, you know, what the situation looks like. I remember seeing some article one time that was saying like, hey, like if you swapped out this and put this in, the 4% rule doesn't work. And I was like, well, like it's not a rule and it wasn't based on that asset allocation. So like, of course it wouldn't work. Like they wouldn't expect it to work. There's also research that shows, right, if you incorporate home equity into the distribution side up front, market drops, borrow from your home, you might be able to find a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate at closer to 6%. Okay, so if we start thinking holistically about our assets and how we're going to use them and what flexibility we're going to allow for year to year, we can come up with a much more, you know, kind of I think, plausible distribution strategy for ourselves. I don't think that there's anything wrong with the research around safe withdrawal rates, because I do think benchmarking somewhere just gives us some guidelines, right? Like, it's okay, maybe it's 2.75, maybe it's 4, not really sure. But if we're at like 8%, we probably know that we don't have a sustainable withdrawal rate. If we're at like 1.75, we're probably underspending. And so somewhere in that range, we can start to get comfortable with things. And the other part about this is, like, the reality of the world is when the markets drop, when the economy is worse, people cut back their spending. They don't do as much. We don't live in a static spending environment. No retiree lives like that. We live in a dynamic spending environment. So any of those models don't align to reality. We have to understand that if we allow for flexibility in our spending and our expenses in retirement, we can increase our average withdrawal rate that will make it, because we will cut back in bad years. And Americans are incredibly resilient. It's, you know, an amazing thing about us is we are incredibly resilient. We find ways to get through troubling times. People find ways to get through retirement. They find ways to cut back and survive and cut costs here and, you know, do other things over here. And that's, you know, it's one of the statements I make. Like, I don't think we're in a retirement crisis. I think individuals have retirement crises, but I don't think as a country we are, because of that fact that Americans find a way to get by. And I think we will continue to be. It doesn't mean that it's as good as it could be, but we will continue to do that. And I do think that safe withdrawal rates are a good guideline and starting point. So we have some parameters about what may work or what may not work, but they shouldn't be treated as some type of rule or holy grail.
So in the book, you single out the qualified longevity annuity contract, or QLAC, as one type of annuity you really like to hedge against longevity risk. Can you talk about why you like that type of product, and also maybe shorthand how those products work? And also thank you for mentioning me as a resource on the topic of annuities. We've tried to clarify and just provide some educational resources around that topic.
Yeah, Christine, you've done a great job of enlightening people and putting out great resources at Morningstar around annuities, and your research there has been great. And one thing I've stated in the book too is I think annuities have been, you know, oversold and underutilized. I think that there is a really valuable place for them, but not always in the way that they're sold to the market. I think they're often oversold as a solution for everything, and that, you know, everything's perfect. And I think we have to be more clear on what the specific purpose of the product is for and strategy. So it's one of the reasons I like the QLAC, is that that qualified longevity annuity contract is like pretty clear on what the purpose is. It does not have as many riders. There aren't as many variations of it, that the government set pretty clear boundaries and rules around it. So we didn't get as messy in the sense that, like, I think every other annuity product, every company argues that theirs is different than the market in 19 different ways. And so it becomes very hard to compare actual products across the scale. And so where I see QLACs kind of fitting in is really taking a portion, which is it's designed to do, of our IRA, or, you know, our deferred retirement account, and essentially push it off into the future, you know, maybe 85, 80, you can pick different time periods to turn on that income. And it's a pretty simple product. You can add a return of, you know, kind of your premium, and there's an inflation protection. But I think the inflation protection, if I remember correctly, only kicks in once the income is on. So it's not running the whole time. But honestly, people have kind of used it, probably not as I would have. It's been kind of sold and positioned as this like way to defer, right, required minimum distributions, which again goes back to like, we're like overselling something that I don't think is as important of a part of it, but it's worked in part of the sales process, which may or may not be good for the whole market. But, you know, that's a very efficient product to generate income later in life. And there's, I think we've mentioned some of these people before, but the, you know, David Blanchett, who used to be at Morningstar, and Michael Finca and Wade Fowle have all done some research on that and kind of the benefits of QLACs into a retirement income portfolio to create that longevity income. And, you know, I wish that more of our annuity products had very clearly stated purposes, as opposed to like 19 different riders that can solve everything under the sun and then maybe don't solve anything.
You talk in the book about how financial planning is just one dimension of retirement planning. What other considerations should be in the mix when people think about their retirement plans?
Well, probably the first one is like, are you going to be happy? You know, it's I do this a lot in rooms now. And I said, if I had two plans for you and like one of them was the most efficient retirement plan ever created, you'd end up with 30% more wealth than any other plan would create. But you'd just be like a 5 out of 10 happiness level. Like you wouldn't be really unhappy, but like you wouldn't really be like super happy. You'd just be kind of like, okay. I was like, or I had a different plan. And you end up with 40% less money than that other one. But, you know, you finish retirement, you go through retirement as like a 9 out of 10. You're like almost as happy as you could possibly be. Like, which plan would you pick? And like, when I do that in front of rooms of people, I don't get anyone that's like, yeah, I'd like kind of like to be miserable and end up with a lot of money. Now, I think a lot of people live that way. I don't think they'd state that they chose to live that way, but they do. And I think that that's part of it is like, what is the spending that we're going to give ourselves permission to use and spend to actually enjoy retirement and be happy? That financials are a means to an end. And what is the actual end that we're trying to achieve, which gets back to that aspirations? Who do we aspire to be? We aspire to be somebody who just ends up with a lot of money but isn't happy. And I've never seen anybody write that down on their aspiration list. So we need to challenge that. And I think, you know, how you spend your time, how you give back, you know, all of those things become really important. You know, where you live, I think, is an important question, too. We talked about housing, but, you know, where you live in retirement isn't just a financial decision. It's a lifestyle decision. And, you know, it can be a health decision, too. And if we don't have that, we, you know, all the money in the world won't really matter if we lose our health. And I think a lot of people have experienced that part through life.
So speaking of how we spend our time, when we had Michael Kitsis on the podcast this summer, we spent a lot of time asking him about his hacks for productivity. He's sort of a famously productive person, and so are you. You do a lot of different things. So I'm wondering if you can share some of your hacks for getting a lot of stuff done. And also, you know, it sounds like you got a busy family life and pursue some of your other interests. So what are your tips for those of us who are attempting to kind of maximize our time on earth allocation?
Yeah. So this will be interesting. I have a couple ones that I think are really good. So I'll start with those. So there's something we do at Carson. And it's not just me. It's called the Six Most. And we tell everybody, we actually print these out. So when you join Carson, you get these on your desk and it's like a Six Most. And you write out what are the six most important things to accomplish that day and that week. And what that allows you to do is actually prioritize. I didn't realize what it was doing at the start, but you might go through your day and do 14 things that really weren't that meaningful and push off the six most important things to do that day. And by focusing on those, you're able to prioritize what is the best use of your time. So that's a really useful tactic. I don't remember where six came from, but I know that there was some math behind that and science, but six most for your day. So I still use a paper notebook. You could use Remarkable. You could type it up. I like writing things down. So I write those down at the start of every day and for the week. That allows me to focus on the right things. The other one is my life has evolved more is delegation and being smart about accountability when you delegate. So people used to just tell me like, hey, delegate, delegate, delegate. And lots of people would be, Jamie, you need to delegate more. And what I realized was my fear of delegation was not because of other people's ability, but that I wasn't setting clear accountability structures, both for myself and for them, so that I could delegate effectively. So that's another one. Defensive calendaring is a big one, which is block off time that you need to do things. We're in a world now with Zoom and Calendly, which I love both tools, but they can just fill up your schedule. And so block off the time, both like personally to work out, spend time with family, to take days off, to do a project if you need Friday, block off Friday. So use your calendar as a tool for your benefit, not a tool to pull you away from things. Now, here's the last one, which there's a lot of disagreement on this one, which is the, I say yes to everything. Yes, if, okay? So it's always like, yes, if, and I put some parameters around it. Now there's other people which are saying like The Art of Quitting, I need that book is out, and like Learn to Say No. I think that you should learn to say yes to all the right things. And the learn to say yes to all the right things is the hard part. What are the qualifiers you put onto something to be able to say yes to it? But I have always adopted that. There was a professor at UPenn that talked about that once, but a lot of people disagree with that one, but that's how I operate. So when you say, how do I end up with all these things? Because I say yes to almost everything.
Well, Jamie, we are so glad that you said yes to us to talk on this podcast. Congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us today.
Well, thank you both for having me on again.
Well, thank you so much. We really enjoyed having you.
Thank you for joining us on The Long View. If you could, please take a moment to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.